and welcome. It's time for another edition of True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim will be with me in a little bit as we cover dumb crimes and stupid criminals. This is going to be a very different type of case than we cover on our show normally. But this story is so bizarre, so twisted, and so many turns. It's like something you would see in an episode of General Hospital or Dynasty or some nighttime soap opera. It's just one of those inconceivable stories that there's no way could be true, but it is. Paul Fronczak is joining us. He is a military veteran and former actor who now works for a nonprofit organization devoted to saving lives. 5 years ago, Paul took a DNA test that disproved the story that he'd been told about his identity. And we're going to hear about this story. His book is called The Foundling, The True Story of a Kidnapping, a Family Secret, and My Search for the Real Me. Welcome to the show, Paul Fronczak. Thank you for being here.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me, and thank you to Darkness Radio.
This is unbelievable. Like I said in the opening, this is something that you would see in some kind of soap opera or nighttime TV program. There's no way that something like this could have happened in real life, yet you are the living proof that life is just as bizarre as anything we could ever create in Hollywood.
Absolutely. And to me, it kind of almost lends itself to The X-Files, which is one of my favorite shows.
Exactly. Fitting right into that kind of strange realm. Let's jump to the start of this, Paul. And thank you so much for agreeing to be with us to share this story. I think this is something unique to bring to our true crime tale. Give us a little background on Paul Fronczak and what happened back in 1964 in April back in Chicago.
All right. So back in April of 1964, Mrs. and Mr. Fronczak had a baby in Michael Reese Hospital. When that baby was less than a day old, still in the hospital, someone dressed like a nurse came in and told Mrs. Fronczak that the doctor had to see the baby, took the baby out of Mrs. Fronczak's arms and was gone, just vanished, not without a trace. And that was the beginning of this whole crazy journey.
So baby Paul is taken by a mysterious person dressed as a nurse, and they were able to find out this person was not a nurse at any hospitals local or in the surrounding area there, correct? She had no ties to this hospital at any point?
Well, no one even knew who she was.
Okay.
And she fit in, except for she wasn't wearing a nurse's cap. The strange part was she abducted Paul at 10 a.m. The hospital didn't notify Mrs. Fronczak until almost 4 p.m. that night.
Was it just I understand things are much different than they are today. Were they even aware that the baby had gone missing, or was that the frantic search from 10 till 4 to try to rectify this before the mother knew?
They had a feeling the baby was missing, but they didn't want to tell Mrs. Fronczak. They thought that hopefully it would turn up, and then, they wouldn't have to say a word about it, and it didn't work out that way.
Unbelievable. Okay,
yeah.
So this baby goes missing, and they finally alert the family. That's, 6 hours after the time this child goes missing? All that
Absolutely.
Time, this baby is gone. They could have been tracking, tracing, following in the footsteps, trying to find out where this child has been abducted. When they tell your mother what happened, how does she react?
Well, what they did was they actually called Mr. Fronczak, who was at work, and said, "We think your child's missing. You need to get to the hospital." So my dad had to go and tell my mom that the baby's missing.
Well, that's definitely a different time nowadays. All right. So they break this news through your father to tell your mother. Your mother's alerted to this. And how quickly is the FBI called in and local law enforcement? How long does it take to start this case really moving and looking for you?
Okay, everything moved really fast. They actually notified 200 police officers and FBI. They descended on Southside Chicago quickly. They searched 600 homes, interviewed 1,000 people by midnight. And the next day, the Postmaster General pledged 175,000 letter carriers to go and conduct a door-to-door search. It was huge.
That is historic. Has there ever been anything done like that before or since? I've never heard of letter carriers getting involved.
No, it was a major effort for the city to try to solve this as quick as they possibly could.
That had to be hard in itself. I mean, how do you, you know, if you're going to investigate, how do you prove or disprove that the person that's standing there talking to you in 1964, that really is their baby or not?
Absolutely. You know, it's, I think it was a valiant effort. I think it was the only thing they could do. You know, we didn't have the internet back then. We didn't have cell phones.
Right.
You know, it was just knock on doors as quick as you could.
So they have everybody that they possibly could out looking for this baby, this missing child. What happens? I mean, how long is this going on, and how long till they eventually find a little boy that seems to fit this bill?
Well, they did this for about a week, and then the FBI actually moved in with my parents, and they stayed with them for a couple of weeks. They had their phones tapped. They went through, you know, fake ransom calls and, you know, all those kind of things. And but they never caught, or they never even came close to finding what happened to Paul. The closest they had was that the fake nurse took a cab driven by this guy named Lee Kelsey. They interviewed him. He was cleared. And he just said he dropped her off on Halstead Street, and that's it. She just vanished.
He didn't ask at that time why the nurse was taking a baby out of the hospital and why he was just dropping her off on Halstead?
You know, I've asked myself that a million times. I mean, as a cab driver, you would think, why is this nurse carrying a baby wrapped up in a blanket, obviously a newborn, right? I mean, it's just,
right.
I don't know. Good question, Dave.
Just as regular part of conversation. Now, where are you going? Oh, down to Halstead. Oh, okay. Is that your baby? Congratulations. You know, you just think that would come up in everyday conversation, especially back in 1964.
Absolutely.
When people weren't absorbed into their own world and actually communicated with one another. But it was just
right.
These weird connections of misconnections that happened the whole way through. So she gets dropped off on Halstead. Is there any trace of her from that moment on?
No, she vanished. Complete, without a trace. That was it.
Huh. Okay. Now, there's a span of 2 years, as I understand, between the vanishing and your appearance. What took place during that two-year span?
So, on the Fronczak side, they were pretty much withdrawn. I mean, as you can imagine, this tragedy happened to them.
Right.
And it's something, I mean, you just don't get over that. And so they just kept to themselves. I was found abandoned almost a year and a half later in Newark, New Jersey. And according to police, I guess the FBI checked out over 10,000 different babies. And when they came across me, I was the only one they couldn't really rule out as being a Fronczak child. But when I was found, I was placed into the system in New Jersey, put into a foster home for almost a year. And then all of a sudden, the FBI showed up and said, we think this is the Fronczak boy.
All right, so when you were found abandoned, where were you found? What was the story behind that moment?
I was found abandoned outside of McCrory's Variety Store, which was like the hottest store on Broad Street in New Jersey. This store was so popular back in the 60s, they actually had their own private subway entrance and departure platform inside the store. And so everybody went shopping at McCrory's. I was found outside the front door in a stroller.
Okay. And how long had you been sitting there? Is there any idea?
According to eyewitnesses, about 6 to 8 hours.
A two-year-old in a stroller for 6 to 8 hours. Man, you must have been on some seriously good narcotics, because I can't keep my kids sitting still at all when they were that age, let alone 6 to 8 hours in a stroller outside of a busy store. What were you? Were there some kind of drugs involved? Were you doped up or anything, or just sitting there watching the world pass by?
From what I gather from information, I think I was sick. I had like a really bad cold, and I don't think I was feeling very well. And later, what I really found out was that that's probably the safest place for me to be. But we'll get to that later.
Okay. All right. Just what strange aspects of this case. So they find you. They put you into the system because nobody's claiming you. How long does it take from the time they find you till they start to think, you know, maybe this is the Franczak kid?
I believe I was in the foster home for a couple of months when a police officer from New Jersey decided to contact the authorities in Chicago and said, I think we might have found the Franczak baby. Because this was still, I mean, the Franczak case was still a hot going case that right. wasn't solved. And it wasn't, you know, it was a different time back then. Right. We didn't have all these kidnappings and all these tragic things happening to kids. You know, it really dominated the news for a long time.
And what about you specifically rang out to this police officer? This might be the kid from Chicago. I mean, again, you'd think they've got enough stuff going on in their own neck of the woods, but you stood out. Why did he reach out and say, we think this is your missing boy?
That's a great question. Something about, I guess, my look, my age, of what they thought, how old I was, just really struck out with this guy. This one cop really must have had a connection with the Franczak kidnapping to think about that, because that's pretty far away.
Right.
You know, New Jersey, Chicago.
So within a few months, they look into this. The FBI gets involved. Why, if they believe you are the missing child for this family, why does it take almost a year before you're brought to them?
Well, first they had to rule out the other 10,000 kids, supposedly. And it was all based on the shape of my ear. Because Paul was only in the hospital for about 16 hours before he was abducted. Hospital never took a footprint, never did a blood type, never did anything. But they had this one picture of Paul. And it's the only picture we have of Paul to this day. And the only way they could do it was by the shape of the ears.
Okay, right, which a lot of people don't know, but that's a really great identifier, the way the earlobes connect to the head, the size of the ear, the canal, the shape. That's a really important identifier that a lot of people overlook. And
right.
I think they use that to disavow Brushy Billy, the guy that claimed to be Billy the Kid, you know, many years after Billy's supposed death, and a few other people in history that have popped up claiming to be the long-lost so-and-so. They've been able to check out the ears because the ears don't lie, is what I've been told. If you don't have fingerprints and you don't have DNA or blood test, the ears are the most important way to identify someone, you know, again, aside from dental records, which of course the baby would not have had at that point. So they look at this ears, and are they finding enough similarity in the ears that you are Paul Franczak to them?
Well, according to what the FBI, the way they worded it,
right.
I couldn't be ruled out. I was the only one that couldn't be 100% ruled out.
Okay.
So therefore they thought I was a kidnapped child.
Now let me ask you, you mentioned they had to rule out 10,000 children. Does that mean that there were 10,000 children that just turned up without a family that had popped up across the United States in that span that would match your age, time era, everything from when you were abducted to that moment?
Supposedly, they went to all the foster homes,
right.
all the adoption agencies and things like that. And those were all the kids that would have fit the sex, age, and possible looks.
And were those all abandoned children?
I don't think so. I think it was just kids that were put in the system.
Okay. All right. Because it seems, you know, that might have been a waste of manpower as well if you're, you know, researching 10,000 children, but many of them were taken away from their families or, you know, surrendered as opposed to just being, you know, abandoned somewhere. That would have maybe made people stand out a little bit further, you would think, in the list. I'm sure that's why you really drew the attention, because you were one that wasn't connected to anybody.
Exactly. Right.
Okay. Now we've got this going on there. They've started the process of elimination. And when do they let the Franczaks know, hey, we may have your child, we may have found Paul?
Okay, so they let them know about 10 months before they actually allow them to adopt me, because they had to undergo psychological testing. And then they also were testing me for a long time to make sure that I was, I guess, in good shape to be adopted.
All right, Paul, hold on a second. Hold on. So you're telling me if somebody abducts my child, takes him away for 2 years. They find my child. I have to adopt my own child?
Exactly, because they couldn't prove medically that I was actually Paul, because there were no blood tests, no footprints, and they were basing it off a picture in the shape of an ear.
Well, I understand there was no DNA testing at that point, but I thought blood tests could determine one way or another that you at least were in the running to be their child. Did the basic blood tests come back matching that you were the blood type that would make sense for them to be the parents?
Well, I'm actually O negative. My parents were neither. And so it was, once again, inconclusive.
Okay.
But so based on the whole package, I couldn't be ruled out 100%.
Okay, so now they have to adopt their missing child, which again seems weird to me, but okay. And what was that process when you talked to your mom and dad about that? What was that process like? Was that mind-boggling to them that they had to jump through hoops in order to get you back? It was easy to take you away, but it was harder than hell to get you back.
Well, you know, Dave, the thing is, it was really hard on my parents.
Right.
And it was tragic. And then they get this call from the FBI saying, we have your child. You need to drive to New Jersey to identify him. So my parents drive from Chicago to New Jersey. And then they're put in a room with the FBI. And the FBI is saying, this is your kidnapped child. And my mom, you know, this was never talked about in our family until just recently. My mom and I actually really talked about a lot of things. And she said, here you have the FBI telling you this is your kidnapped child. What are you supposed to do? Say no? If you do, you're turning away a child that needs a home. And if you say yes, do you really know for sure? You have to take it on faith. Plus, back then, the FBI was the highest authority figure you could possibly have telling you.
Oh, okay. And I don't mean to laugh. It's just everything about this is so absurd. So your mom at the point, she's kind of thinking, well, we don't have a kid now because of this. This kid needs a home. We're not sure he's ours, but the FBI is thinking it. So, yeah, we'll just go along. Because it seems weird, right, doesn't it? Hey, we need you to come identify this baby that you probably saw for just a couple of hours 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's now 2.5 years old and has aged dramatically, and you maybe saw for a few hours one day. 2.5 years. That seems weird. How do you come on in and identify him? Yep, there's the tag on his ass. I remember him. That's him, right? I mean, that is so bizarre.
It's so crazy. And, you know, and my mom said, she took one look at me and she said, that's my son. And I mean, that was it. And I became Paul.
Well, there's goodness then, right? You've found your home. You've found your family. And no longer living in the system. Do you have any memory of that time of your life at all? Any of the living in foster care or going through the legal process to get to be back with your parents?
I don't have any memories. I think I have a lot of repressed memories. But I was fortunate enough to meet this lady, Janet, who was the daughter of the foster family that had me for almost a year. She was in her 20s then. And she said that her parents took a liking to me and they really wanted to adopt me. They actually, they named me Scott McKinley. They had me baptized and I was actually part of their family. I've seen pictures of me during that time. They're about the only baby pictures I have. And, I look really happy.
Okay. That's fantastic. So you've got multiple families that love you. You're brought into a good environment when it came to this foster care system. Now you're going to go be with your biologic family the FBI is telling your family and assuring the foster people that this is where you belong. So once they've passed this, you go, it's a total of, you said, almost a year from the time they found you to when your parents were able to reclaim custody and take you over.
Correct.
Okay. And now walk me through that stage. Your child growing up in this household, everything is normal. It appears from everything I've read and watched, they're a very loving family. You've found your home.
Dave, the Franzeks were the best parents you could ever imagine. I mean, they saved my life literally. and I had a great childhood growing up. The only thing I would say is that I was a little overprotected, and I couldn't do a lot of things that my friends could, because coming off a kidnapping, your parents tend to be a little more protective of you.
Yeah, these aren't the helicopter parents of today, folks. These are parents that already lost him once and were going to be very cautious about not losing him again.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, things, again, begin to change for you at, what, about the age 10 years old? Is that right?
Yeah. I found out what happened when I was 10.
And how did you find that out? I mean, is it something that was accidentally brought up at a family party by, you know, drunk Uncle Larry who can't keep his mouth shut, or some other way?
This is something that the family never, ever spoke of. I was actually being a true 10-year-old snooping around the house before Christmas looking for Christmas presents. And I actually went in the crawl space, and I found these boxes hidden in the back of the crawl space. And I thought, this is it, the big score, right? It's going to be a great Christmas. And I started looking through these boxes and packages, and I realized that it's all newspaper clippings, letters, sympathy cards, even a letter from the Pope expressing sympathy. And I started reading the headlines, and it says, you know, city searches for Franz Act baby. And I start to read it, and all of a sudden I see a picture of my mom and dad, and it says, city searches for Paul Joseph Franz Act. And I started realizing that this was all about me. And that was just a whirlwind of questions.
Yeah, what is that like? Okay, you find this. Do you drag it out and tell mom and dad and then put yourself in the risk of them realizing you were snooping for Christmas presents? What, you know, because, again, that 10-year-old mindset's got to be kicking in, preservation of not getting in trouble for nosing around, but then the curiosity factor's got to be overwhelming.
That's exactly what happened, Dave. I was so curious. I grabbed one of the clippings, went upstairs, told my mom that I found this, and this is about me. What is this? And my mom got really mad, number one, for snooping around the house. And then number two, finding something I shouldn't have found. Mm-hmm. And so basically she said, you were kidnapped. We found you. We love you. That's all you need to know. We will never talk about this again. And we never did.
That had to be weird too, right? You get that as your only answer and you just have to accept it and move on. Did you try to question grandpas and grandmas, aunts, uncles, other siblings, anything?
You know, I didn't, because my parents were my authority figures, and I believed them. And they tell me that I was kidnapped, I was found. That's all that mattered to me. I was Paul. You know what? Let's go find those presents.
Right. That all came back down to the presents. I get you. All right. Now that you're 10 years old, you're aware of this situation. Does it feel like a burden knowing that at all? Or is it just like one of those, oh, no, when you were a kid, you fell and broke your arm. Oh, okay, Mom. And it's just one of those facts of life, and you move on.
You know, that's a great question, Dave. I didn't realize it then. But as I got older, I carried it with me every day. And I always carried clippings with me. And I've always told people in my life that story. And it's always been a huge part of me without me realizing how big it really was until I got older. Does that make sense?
Sure. After you were found, Paul, were there any other attempts from hoaxers to reach out and fleece your family for money, any kind of, you know, shenanigans like that? Because obviously you said when you first went missing and the FBI had set up the wiretaps and all the information, they were getting ransom calls and things, because people are just morons and everybody's trying to cash in on a tragedy at that moment and insert themselves into the story. Did any of those leads inspire them or get them onto any kind of path at all? And then after you were found, did those kind of calls ever continue?
You know, I don't remember any like other ransom calls or scams like that, but I do remember when I was about maybe 13 or 14, the phone rang in the house. I answered the phone, and a guy identified himself as a detective for Chicago. He said, can I talk to your mom? I think we found the kidnapper. I was excited. I ran down to my mom, who was on the phone. My mom said, hang up the phone. Don't ever answer that phone again. And I was stunned. I mean, I understand my mom's place and where she was coming from because it was so traumatic. But at the same time, I thought, wow, we might be able to really catch this person, you know? And it just, that really stuck with me all these years. And I really wonder what that detective really had to say. He never called again.
Okay. Does that seem strange to you? Because if there really was a connection and they think that they'd found this person, don't you think that they would have continually kept on your mom and dad because they would want their help to go forward in prosecuting and arresting this person?
Absolutely. I think they would have sent officers to the door. Because, I mean, a lead that big, it just doesn't go away. You know, and my mom actually had interaction with that nurse. You know, she talked to her.
Right.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know, this whole journey has been like one big roller coaster of just peaks and valleys, from the happiest places to the most dark places. And all those things all fit in line with how crazy the story really is.
Right. And that's what I said. I just sit back, even though I know the timeline of the story, and I'm learning more of the little, you know, snippets of the history. It's just every time it's like a smack in the face. Like, wait, what just happened? How did this happen? Paul, and I thought I had a rough life when I didn't get the Lone Ranger doll I wanted for Christmas. You've been through it all, man. So she gets this call. Did she ever admit to you later or your father that they did take a call from any of these police officers and talked about it? Or was that a one and done phone call? And if it was, what do you make of that now as an adult?
That was a one and done deal. And my mom and dad, they came from that era where if you don't talk about something, it's almost like it never happened. And we never talked about the kidnapping or anything having to do with it almost my entire life until I started this whole DNA thing.
Right.
And just recently, my mom actually sat down and talked to me about how she was feeling and what was going through her mind. And it took a long time for her to open up.
Well, we'll continue then with your story and then get to those feelings and that aspect of it, because I think that's an important wrap as well. This one-time call, now, tell me as an adult, does this ring then to you that it was just another fraud, somebody else maybe looking to fleece or screw with your family, since it was a one-time only call and the cops weren't knocking on the door to try to solve this?
You know, honestly, from what I've gotten from my interaction with law enforcement over the last couple of years, I think maybe they just said, okay, they're not interested, let's just move on. You know, it could have been a good tip. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But it just seems like, I don't know, the follow-through just really isn't there.
Did you ever do research to see if that officer, or do you remember what the officer's name was, or no, because you were so young?
No, I don't even know his name. I wish I would have taken notes, you know, but
right,
when you're that young, you don't think about it. Like, mom, phone call. Okay, I'll hang up. Right?
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
Did you, when you set the phone down to go get your mom, did she take the phone and answer it, or did she tell you to just go up and hang up the phone?
She told me to go and hang up the phone.
So you didn't say anything? You just picked it up and hung it up?
I just hung it up, man. You know, you listen to your parents, you know, at least, you know, back then we did.
Wow. I wish my kids were like that, man. I got to tell them 100 times to do something before they listen. You're doing it on the first. That's great. You've got this hanging over you, and that had to even add more into your baggage, if you will. You find this at age 10. A few years later, you get a phone call like that. Mom shuts it down, not getting the answers that you would think everybody would want to know. Do you ever, and I know obviously you're talking about this, and I bring up the good son aspect, because you would think, you know, normally people would start to maybe act out a little bit because of this trauma and because of the mindset of what the hell really happened in my life.
Well, you know, it's my parents were very protective of me,
right?
And they said, they came out and told me I was kidnapped, I was found, everything's good, but then they also said, you know, there's a lot of bad people out there and they might try to scam us. They didn't want me using my last name for a lot of things because they were afraid it would re-spark this whole thing. And, I mean, they went through a really bad time with reporters. They were camped out on the lawn.
Right.
They were climbing telephone poles trying to get pictures of them. It was a really bad, bad thing for them, a bad experience. It's bad enough to have your child kidnapped, but then have to deal with that as well. So I was raised with the fact that really don't trust anybody because someone could have an angle and trying to scam us for something.
Right. Right. Which again is a sad reality of life. Now we flash forward many years because you've just accepted this. It's part of your life. You respect and love your family. There's nothing to think about. It is what it is. At what point does this story start to really break open for you?
I started getting a little older, and I realized that I didn't look, act, resemble, have any mannerisms like my parents or my brother Dave. And, you know, it's once again, it's like those clippings I carry with me all my life. I didn't realize the importance of it until I got older and I had my own daughter. And within 6 months of my daughter, I realized that she had my mannerisms, my characteristics, my expressions, and I never had that with my parents. So I really started to wonder if I was really their child. And, you know, and that really stayed with me. And then...
And that didn't hit you until you were an adult? That aspect really started to play into you?
Yeah, it really hit me hard once I had my daughter. I mean, I always had my doubts. I mean, I used to joke about, you know, stealing my parents' hair when they were visiting or whatever, you know, to do a DNA test. But, of course, they were never affordable, and it wasn't like it is today where you can do it.
Right.
But I've always had questions in the back of my mind. But I never, I mean, out of respect to my parents, I never really did anything about it.
Right. You never challenged it.
Correct.
And you really, I mean, in all honesty, you never really had a need to. You had a loving family. It wasn't like you were trying to get out and, man, these people suck. I have to prove I'm not their son. That wasn't part of your reality. So why even bother to challenge it? But now you've got
Absolutely.
A daughter. You're noticing these small idiosyncrasies that match with you, and you realize just how far there is a gap between you and your parents. What do you do that suddenly breaks this case open?
My parents came out to visit us like they often did. And about a month earlier, I was in a CVS drugstore and I saw something I couldn't believe. It was an Identigene paternity test and it was affordable. So I bought it, I put it in the closet, and I thought one day I'm going to have the nerve to actually do this. And when my parents came out, they came out like a Friday through Sunday. And I waited till Sunday night, almost up to the point of taking them to the airport. And I thought, this is it. I have to do something about this. It's eating me alive. So I said, Mom, did you ever really wonder if I was your child? And she said, yeah, we've thought about it. I said, well, what if we could prove it right now? Would you be interested? She said, sure. I ran to the closet, got the DNA kit out. Within 3 minutes, we were all swabbing away. And I thought, this is amazing. I'm really going to find out for sure.
And how was that? Because, again, this is a unique situation many of us will never go through. Are you guys laughing about this? Is this kind of a, you know, a joke? Is it something that you guys are taking very seriously? Talk me through that process.
Okay. I think the fact that I got them so off guard that they really didn't have time to process what was happening. And I was making it as light as I could, you know, just funny. I've always used humor as a defense mechanism in
right.
my life.
Sure.
And this was a moment that I really wanted to see through without scaring anybody off. So we were just joking around, and the whole process only took a couple of minutes, you know. And once I had it all done and sealed up, I thought, this is it. I took my parents to the airport. Not a word was said all the way to the airport. And I think it was setting in that they realized that we had just started something that could possibly be the hugest game changer ever.
And you mail that in how quickly after you get back home?
Well, my parents got back to Chicago. They called me and they said, we don't want to know. We don't want you to do this. And so I was torn because I've always been a son who listens to my parents, but this was bigger than all of us put together.
Right.
I waited almost 2 weeks, Dave. I had it set up in my desk drawer in my home, and I walked by it every day. And I kept thinking, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. And finally, I grabbed it, ran to the mailbox, and dropped it in. And, of course, it got stuck. It wouldn't go all the way down. So I actually had a bang on it to get it to fall into the mailbox. So I had all these opportunities to not do it, but I actually had to force myself to fit it in that mailbox. I was determined.
And then you wait.
Yeah.
And now, are you married at this time? Are you divorced? What's your personal life like?
I was married. My wife didn't want me to do it.
Why didn't your wife want you to do it? I think she would understand your want and desire to know the truth.
She understood that, but she also understood my parents didn't want it done. And she was raised like I was, you know, you listen to your parents. So it was really hard for her. But I said, you know what, I can't not do this. This is what really got me was a doctor asked me about my medical history for my daughter. And I really didn't believe what I was saying because I really didn't know for sure if my parents were my parents.
Right. Right. And, you know, the reason part of the story sticks with me so much, Paul, is the fact that I don't know my biological father. And that question and want and desire, when you look in the mirror and you wonder, do I have their eyes? The smirk, you know, the eyebrow, what is this mom? Is this me? Is this him? I understand that basic need to just want to know more about where you came from. And I have a wonderful stepfather who raised me since I was about 2 years old. And, you know, it's not like I was looking to replace him, but I wanted to know more about where I came from. So I really get where you're coming from and that question. And especially, yeah, when you have to answer medical history, you know, tell me, you know, what about your father's side? I don't know. I can't answer that. I don't know what it was like. Yeah, that would drive you crazy, and especially as a parent, because you want to give the most knowledge you can to your medical staff so that they can take care of your children the best they could.
Absolutely, Dave. I mean, it's something that never goes away. That feeling is always there on your mind.
Right.
Wow, that's incredible.
So it takes how long till this test returns to you?
Almost 2 weeks. And I was at work when I got the phone call.
Now, the phone call, is this your wife calling to say, honey, it's here, or are they calling you with test results?
They're calling me with test results.
All right. You get the call, you steel yourself. What happens next?
So I get the phone call. I'm at work. I'm working for a college. And the guy asked me like 25 security questions. And I'm thinking, this is like NASA. Well, why so many questions? And then he asked me, he goes, what's the reason you did this test? And I said, well, I want to know if my parents are really my parents. And he said, well, the results are in. There's no remote possibility that they are your biological parents. And even though inside I knew this, I knew it for a long time. I wasn't really Paul. It just, when I heard it, it's like my whole life just flashed before me. I mean, I felt the color drain from my face. Everything I believed in, my birthday, my medical history, a Taurus. I never believed I was a Taurus. You know, it's things like that. It's just, I was living a lie. And all of a sudden, I didn't know what to do next.
Yeah, that's got to be just a gut check. And even, like you said, you know, it's one thing, and kind of likening it to, you know, if you've been in a relationship where you think you're being cheated on, you may have a good suspicion you're being cheated on. It's in your mind, it's there, but it's still comfortably tucked far enough away that the hurt isn't as deep. But the minute you find out, even though you knew it, it is like somebody just shot a cannon through your stomach, right?
Absolutely.
And it's that, you know, there's one thing of thinking, and then there's another thing of knowing, and now you know. When did you pick up that phone and call mom and dad and say, hey, I've got to talk to you?
Okay, that's another journey. I didn't do that for quite a while because I went home and thought about this for a couple of days.
Right.
And I thought, all I want to do is find the real Paul. Because my parents raised me, they're the most amazing people ever. The greatest gift I can give them as their son would be to find out what happened to their real child.
Wow.
And I thought, this can't be hard, you know? You know, so I thought,
wait a minute, you think 40-some years later, this can't be hard in a cold case that they ran out of information within, hours of her going missing, and they've never found any kind of leads. And your thought process is, yeah, I can solve this. I got the internet.
Exactly. I got Google. What else do I need?
That's awesome. Now, I first of all, I want to just tell you, I applaud the fact that your initial thought was, I need to solve this for my parents. I need to find out what happened to Paul. That is amazing. It wasn't about you. And let's face it, most of us, myself including, probably would have folded in, and it would have been a lot about me. It would have been, oh, my God, my life, what has happened to me? Me, 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 you people led me through a lie. I can tell that would be kind of the response most of us would have. But it's amazing that your first thought is, we've got a mystery to solve. Let's get this thing underway. My parents need an answer. I applaud you on that, because that's an amazing aspect of your personality that, you know, your parents, biological or not, brought you up the right way, sir. You definitely receive something from them that is far beyond blood. So I applaud that was your first thought to answer their biggest question now.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. I really appreciate it. You know, it's funny. I didn't even think about my identity until I started getting into this and
right.
We started this journey. And then I started working with my first thought was how to get this out into the public to help solve this. I thought of only one guy out here, George Knapp.
Right.
He broke Area 51. I mean, the guy's a legend, right? He was a real reporter. So I sent him a very brief email on a Saturday afternoon. I said, this is my situation. Are you interested? He got back in about 10 minutes and said, I want to meet you. So I met him Monday at the studio. We're talking. And then he said, what about you? Do you not even know who you are? And I started thinking, yeah, you're right. Maybe we should work on this too.
Yeah, you put yourself in the back seat on this. Now, at the point you went to George Knapp, had you even told your parents yet that the test came back negative?
No, because my parents made it clear they didn't want me to do it. So I didn't want to tell them anything until I had information that would really be beneficial.
You needed leverage. You didn't want to get punished. I understand.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard enough to go against your parents' wishes,
right.
But then to go against it with nothing to back it up. You
right.
Know?
Right. No.
Like
so
said,
I get
like
you.
Said,
you wanted to trade off. You wanted to give them, mom and dad, listen, I did the test. I'm not your son, but I think I know who is, or I know what happened. And at least that's the trade off. Now you've, again, like your sense of, I always had this feeling it's not me. You got that gut punch in reality. Your family, your mom and dad always believed that there was a chance you might not be theirs. But until they're faced with that harsh reality, you wanted to give them something to soften that blow.
Absolutely. Yes.
Again, I applaud that. That's phenomenal. So you start this research. What is George Knapp, who we love and, you know, I work with on Coast to Coast AM and respect wholeheartedly, what was his approach on this? What was his advice?
George is like the coolest guy ever. We sat down and talked for about 2 hours, and he said, we've got to do a segment. We've got to get this out. The quicker we get it out, we'll get responses. We can use the public like they tried to back in the 60s with the initial kidnapping to help solve it now. And that's exactly what we did. And George and I worked on a couple of pieces together, and it seemed like overnight it went national. And it was all over the country again, and even international. It was huge.
And yet you still hadn't told your parents what you knew?
Well, after a couple of stories aired, I decided the best way to tell them would be in a letter.
Right.
Because they're both in their 80s. In a phone call, I thought they wouldn't hear it all the way through.
Right.
They would only pick up certain words and shut down because that's how I am on the phone.
Right.
I thought if they could read it, they could process it at their own speed. They could reread it and reread it and really, really envelope every single word.
Exactly.
And so that's the method I used to tell them.
Okay. And you send this letter off to them after these stories are out, but it's breaking again, international. It hasn't crossed their TV screen, newspaper, internet. They're totally out of the loop that you've taken it this far.
I think I timed it just right that everything just happened at the same time, luckily. And I didn't get the response I was hoping for. When they read the letter, they were very, very mad. And, you know, I thought that they would understand the reason I was doing it was to kind of give them a present. And they took it like I was very unhappy and trying to find other parents, which was never even the case.
Right. And I've got friends that have been adopted that have run into similar situations like that. And it is, it's, it's tough. They had already suffered one massive loss that took 2 years to fill. And that still left them a question in the back of their head. And they did the best possible job they could with you. And then to get that, I can see how from that other side it might look that way, even though knowing your mindset and being in that kind of position myself of wanting to know, you know, it's a strange conundrum. Were you surprised and shocked by their reaction to this overall?
I was sad. I mean, honestly, I was really sad. I thought that we could work on this together. It would be like a family project and we would find the real son. And I thought it would just be like the most amazing thing ever. And it turned out I did it all on my own, you know. It was a lonely venture, but it was a hell of a ride.
And your parents, you became estranged from them for a period of time, is that right?
About 3 years.
3 years. Would you continually try to reach out and they just wouldn't respond, or?
It got to the point where I figured, you know, they're gonna come around. They're gonna realize, see the bigger picture of things, and I'm gonna give them some time, because you know you can't force something. It's gotta happen by itself. And so I just stopped trying.
All right. Well, we won't belabor that. There's still so much of your story to tell. George tells you, well, we need to know who you are. You need to know who you are. We need to find who Paul really is and what happened to Paul. So you launch this campaign. What kind of responses are you getting back from the world regarding this?
The responses were phenomenal. George and I set up a Who Is Paul Facebook page, which is still active now. And we use it for getting tips and information. We started and we had about 10 people on there. Now we have about 20,000. And I was getting calls and letters. And then I started getting packages from Barbara Walters and all the networks, getting phone calls from Anderson Cooper and Matt Lauer. Everybody wanted to help with the story. And it was huge. And it happened so fast.
All right. Well, let's take a left turn off of the story of Paul. And let's go down your journey. How do you start piecing together what happened to you and who you are and where you came from?
Okay, so you mentioned Coast to Coast.
Right.
Thankfully, George Knapp had me on Coast to Coast 3 times. The first episode I did, Matt Dayton from Ancestry DNA was listening. He reached out to us and said, why don't you do a DNA kit? Maybe we can help you find some real family through that. And during that time, George also had me do a family tree DNA kit as well. And so that started the whole thing with finding out who I was.
Well,
I was
Paul,
more into finding Paul, and
right.
I thought, well, let's do this.
Well, Paul, you've got to help me out here with this aspect of it. Because a lot of people don't even understand what these tests are. I mean, most of us, you know, our only exposure to DNA is from watching CSI or Maury Povich, right? You are not the daddy. How can you get, how can Paul do a cheek scraping, turn it in, and find family out there if you don't know who you're comparing it to? How is that even possible?
It's amazing. Ancestry, their DNA tests check over 720,000 markers, and they take you back hundreds of years. And I mean, anyone who was related to you, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth cousins, if they're out there, they're going to pop up. The only downside to me was that I didn't know that every company out there has their own database and they don't share information. So if you really want to do this on your own, you need to test with every single company, because you might have a match with FamilyTree that's not with Ancestry. Huh. And if you don't test with, if you miss one of those companies, you might be missing out on a biological hit.
But this means that somebody in your biologic family has to have also taken a scraping and sent it in to Ancestry or Family Tree or one of these different DNA testing sites.
Correct.
Okay.
You know, it's the closest. It's like throwing darts. You know,
sure.
You're getting as close as you can to the bullseye. And you know, it's almost like fishing, right? You need the biggest net possible to catch something. And so I figured it's the only thing I can do, so I might as well do it.
Can I ask kind of a weird off the topic question on this? I don't know, having done what you were involved in and all of this research and finding these venues, isn't it possible that those venues, ancestry and family tree, might be really helpful in capturing a criminal? Because if there's a rape or a crime that occurs, that DNA evidence is left behind and we can't match it because that person's not in the database, but there's a chance maybe one of their family members is in the database. And then putting it through that, those different profiles to pull it together, I would think could narrow down cold cases in a heartbeat. Because if you've got family members that did this, and then we can start tracking down, well, yeah, obviously it's not me, but you know, I have a third cousin who's been in and out of jail a lot you might want to talk to. What a powerful tool. Are they using that at all? Are you aware?
You know, that's a great question, because what you just said, I've said before, and I think it would help solve so many cases.
Right.
I do know that they ran, supposedly the FBI ran my samples through the criminal database.
Right.
I don't really know if they did or not, but that's a great point, and I think it would help solve a lot of cases out there.
But nobody is claiming that they've got that at this point.
Correct.
Well, obviously, I think Paul, you and I need to get together in a new business venture where we're going to tie all these databases together and start running crime test lab deals to see if we can provide using all of these different pools. Let's start it up now. We've got a whole new business. We can save even more lives, Paul.
Absolutely, and it would work.
I know it would, right. I mean, imagine how many people you'd take off the street that are really bad people on something that's being done already and is being given willingly. There are so many people that don't want to do DNA samplings because they're afraid they're going to be profiled for something else. But if there are already willing participants that could help us close down other crimes, what a fantastic opportunity.
Absolutely.
So this goes through these different venues. They start breaking down and finding living relatives for you and saying, and how quick are you getting these responses back, Paul?
Okay, once again, Dave, I thought a couple of weeks we're done.
Right.
No. I had zero matches for a long time.
Okay.
And then one day, a second cousin popped up. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe it. A second cousin. That's the only name that popped up.
Now,
right?
How do they know it's a second cousin? Is it just the way the DNA breaks down that they can say, okay, we can tell that the basics are here, which means that you're related this way, and then they jerk over this way, which means it must be a different branch of the tree, and then they come over here, which makes him a cousin?
Yeah, it's based on centimeters of your DNA strands.
Okay.
And how many match, and the percentage of matching. And it's a science, and it's dead on. And I'm fortunate enough to have C.C. Moore, who's probably the top genealogist in the country, maybe even the world, I don't know. But she also heard my story and reached out on the Facebook page and helped me for about 4 years with her team, pro bono, of course. And they're actually the ones who solved the mystery of who I am. But I only had this one match. And I reached out. I spoke with him on the phone. His name was Alan. Nicest guy in the world. But once again, this is a journey, right? He was adopted, didn't know his real parents. So he was so happy that him and I were talking because he wanted to find his real family. Turns out his kids gave him this DNA kit as a present, and he had just got his results back. And that's when he popped up with me.
Okay, so now there's a flag up, and you've got this. But now he's kind of in the same boat you are.
Exactly. Didn't know who his parents were.
How do you then open it further to understand who everybody is? Because this sounds like another dead end to us.
It really does. Luckily, I was able to do a 2020 with Barbara Walters.
Okay.
And with the power of 2020, they were able to open his adoption records. They had his mom listed, but there was no father. The mom refused to give up any information and wouldn't cooperate at all. But once again, it's all timing and luck.
Right.
I had a fourth cousin that popped up whose grandfather told her all these stories and happened to tie the family into New Jersey. And that's where Alan's real mom went to high school. My fourth cousin actually knew Alan's mom and remembered a guy that she was dating when she was 16. And later, through almost another year and a half of researching, turned out that that was actually my second cousin. He was actually the father of Alan.
Wow. What a fascinating yeah. twist. Okay. So how long till we're able to figure out who Paul Fronczak really was? From start to the minute you break that code, how long does it take?
Okay. I didn't find out. Okay, I started this in 2012. I didn't find out who I was until June 3rd of 2015.
And when you finally get that information, how is it brought to your attention? Who delivers the call or message to you?
Okay, so real quick, like Cece Moore and her team, we have been in constant contact for almost 3 years. I mean, phone calls in the middle of the night, emails, texting, you know, whenever a tip would come up, we would just research it. And I mean, I'm on my computer constantly. They're doing all kinds, they're knocking on doors. And, you know, we get a lead and then they'd be shot down. We get another lead and something would happen. Like Alan, I was supposed to meet Alan. 2 days before we're supposed to meet, he wakes up not feeling so well, goes to the hospital, tells everyone, you got to run these tests quickly. I'm going to meet my real cousin. He died 2 hours later.
No.
Yeah. That's how this whole journey has been. And it's all in the book, The Foundling. And it's a journey. It's just not, you know, a quick answer for something. It's a complete journey.
Right.
Yeah. So Cece Moore calls me. Well, she texted me. I was at work once again. And she said, do you want to go to a safe place and give me a call? I said, sure. So whenever Cece would text me, I never knew what to expect. So I always thought of a safe place to talk. I went out to my car and called her. And she said, what do you think of the name Jack? I said, that's a great name. It's a strong name. She said, that's your name. And then she said, hold on. There's more. You had a twin. Her name was Jill. Jack and Jill.
Get out of here. Jack and Jill.
Yep. Crazy, huh?
might as well have been Luke and Leia, right? At this point, you're waiting to find out Darth Vader's your real father or what, Paul?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So you have a twin sister that was also born. And how did she track this down? I mean, what was the way that she was able to break this? Or is that the kind of thing that she's not even able to really tell because it's, you know, maybe there was a little bit of behind the scenes work going on?
Well, it's all laid out really nicely and as easily as possible in my book, The Foundling.
Right.
Because it gets pretty intricate, but it took a lot of knocking on doors and researching. And it's so strange how this really did happen because I had Ashkenazi Jewish on both sides of my family, which made it really hard to tie together the family tree to place Jack and Jill. And they got close. They heard stories of in this family about an uncle who had twins, but it turns out they had the wrong uncle, and that story almost faded away. We got lucky with a newspaper clipping from a New Jersey newspaper when the twins were born in Atlantic City, because it was the same birthday, October 27th, as my parents' anniversary and my older sister's birthday. So the newspaper put a blurb in there, big day for my family, you know, Jack and Jill were born. And that sealed the deal with the twins.
All right. Wow. What an amazing find. It's so incredible what kind of information is still out there and available to us.
It's crazy.
You find out who you are. Now you start reaching out. You've got a sister a couple years older than you, correct?
Correct, yes.
And you first reach out to her, and there's kind of this excitement because she's going to meet her little brother. You're going to meet your sister. How does that evolve for you?
Okay, actually, I never reached out to her because one of Cece's team found out her address and went to check it out. And neighbors said that she was really, really dangerous. Stay away from her. So no one ever approached her, but we had an address. I actually had spoken to my real brother, who's younger. We talked on the phone, and he seemed really positive. At first, he was shocked because he never heard of the twins. Parents never talked about it. Family never even mentioned the twins. They just made us vanish. And So, and then all of a sudden he changed. He said, I don't believe this. I think it's a scam. I want nothing to do with you. But I had my sister's address. So I hopped on a plane, went down to Atlantic City, and just knocked on her door.
And how did that reception happen? I mean, was she excited to see you? Was she angry?
I knocked for almost 20 minutes. And I thought nobody was home. And I came all this way. I wasn't going to just knock once and leave. So I kept knocking, and eventually I saw a shadow walking towards the door. And all of a sudden, the door opened. I took a step back. I didn't know what to expect, you know. But she said, hi. And I said, hi, I'm your brother. She said, I know. Come on in. And I went in, and we talked for almost an hour.
So your sister tells you, I know who you are. Were you surprised by that response?
I was. And at that point, I didn't know what to expect. But I was happy to hear that. It made it a lot easier.
She brings you in. Is it a welcoming? I mean, now you've been told this is a dangerous woman. You don't know what to expect. You've just spent 20 minutes pounding on the door, and her response to you is, I know who you are.
Yeah. I was very cautious, I guess, to put it nicely. I came in and sat down and just started talking with her. And within a few minutes, it felt really, really comfortable, just a nice conversation.
When she said she knew who you were, did she explain any further what that meant? Was she just always expecting that knock to come on her door?
You know, that's the feeling I got. I didn't ask anymore. I just figured she saw me on TV or saw one of the news clips or something, you know, because the story was everywhere.
Right.
But it was, yeah, I just came in and sat down and started talking, you know. I had so many questions on my mind that it was kind of a blur.
Was she responsive to the questioning? Were there points where she wanted to hold off or not give you more information?
Yeah, it felt like that. She wasn't really sure of the whole story herself. I mean, here she spent her whole life never hearing of these twins, and all of a sudden, this guy shows up at her door who's her younger brother. And it's got to be surreal, because it was surreal for me.
Well, she was 2 years older than you?
Yes.
So she would have been about 4 or 5 when you went missing, right? And she has
exactly.
She has no memory of having twin brother and sisters?
Exactly. It's something I have a hard time believing.
Right. Understandably. All right. Now, what happens with her? Is she always receptive to you, or much like your younger brother, does she suddenly shut you out?
So it's like she didn't want me to leave. You know, she gave me a hug and she made plans for me to come back the next day to have lunch with her and her daughter. She had a 16-year-old daughter, which would, you know, be my niece. And I thought, this is terrific. Yeah, I'll come back tomorrow. We'll go out for lunch and talk some more. We got to the car, and all of a sudden, I get an email from my brother saying, don't ever contact me again. This is a scam. I want nothing to do with you. And my sister had just told me that her younger brother has never talks to her. He only texts her.
Right.
Has never met her 16-year-old daughter, even though he comes to town twice a year for his wife's family reunion. Never stops in to see her. But yet, I think the minute I left, I think she texted him to say, Paul, Jack was just here. And he said, shut it down. Don't ever talk to him again. Because I went back the next day to get her for lunch, and she didn't answer the door. There was no answer on her phone, nothing. It just shut me out completely.
And you've never found a reason why? She never got any clear what happened, and your brother was not forthcoming after that point?
I've heard nothing from neither, and I've reached out numerous times to both of them.
I would think they would want their story told. Why do you think that there's this need to hide the story?
Well, there's a crime involved. There's a possible murder involved. And they both have extreme baggage from living in that family.
Right.
The stories I've heard were just gruesome. And luckily, I got out. They didn't. So I can only imagine what they went through their whole lives. So there's just there's a lot of reasons why I think they don't want to talk about it, but I'm not going to quit until they do.
You mentioned a crime, a possible murder. Let's talk about that. Your sister, Jill. Are there any leads on Jill? Where she could be? What happened to her?
I've heard numerous accounts from close relatives that are, you know, actually my family, that are very nice, welcoming, forthcoming, stories of just major, major abuse. And a story of one of the twins being dropped and a possible death or murder. And that's what led to my abandonment, because they couldn't just explain having one twin around the house. My parents actually told each side of the family that the other side was watching the twins. And then they even told some family members that the twins were adopted, it didn't work out, and they gave them back. But I have Jill's and my birth certificates. So I know that we were actually born into their family.
Unreal. Who were your real parents? Were they drug runners, mob enforcers? What? Why would they be like this, and why all the secrets?
You know, that's a great question. And I'm actually in the middle of piecing together their lives from stories and facts from other family members. My dad was in the Korean War, and I guess when he came back, he was a mean, changed man. And then he became a cop on the Atlantic City boardwalk. His brother, Leonard, my uncle, who I actually got to meet, we tracked him down. He was actually friends with Nicky Scarfo, who actually ran the mob.
Oh.
So yeah, my dad's a cop, and his brother's hanging out with Nicky Scarfo.
So there is some shadiness to this family. And I've seen you have just one picture or have you found more now, but one picture of your mother while she was pregnant with you and your twin sister.
That's the only picture I have right now. And I have pictures of my dad when he was younger, but it's strange because I have cousins, Sandy and Joy. They have 1,000 family albums, not one picture of the twins and no pictures of my parents when they were older. It's like once this thing happened with the twins, they just took themselves out of the picture with the whole family. And we actually found a photo album that my grandma had. It was chronological of all the kids. And where the twins were supposed to be, there were two pages ripped out.
Interesting. So in their, and again, this is all just hypothesis, but in their idea, one of, obviously, Jill may have been accidentally killed or killed, and we don't know how to answer to that. So let's get rid of both kids?
Yeah. Crazy, isn't it?
Beyond crazy. That's why I said this is soap opera material. This is not real life stuff that's going on in this story. All right. So you've got answers for you to a degree. But
right.
Both of your parents have passed, your biological parents.
Correct.
Correct. Yes. Siblings do not want to communicate at this point.
Right.
Is it, it seems in this day and age, money talks, has the offer of money being exchanged for information ever come up yet? Or is that something that you're hoping doesn't have to?
Yeah. I mean, you know, at this point, I'm pretty much willing to do anything to close these stories. I mean, I'm not a rich man, but I'll do what I have to do. Like I have for the last 5 years.
I would guess there has got to be some major networks out there that would love this story and would be willing to pay your sister and brother in order to come forward and tell these stories. And again, not trying to sound judgmental, but from the video footage of your sister's home, looks like she could use some money to maybe, you know, better herself in her situation. It might be an opportunity for, you know, for her. I would think that one of these networks would love to make that happen for you, especially when you had Barbara Walters and Matt Lauer and all of these major people reaching out to you. Where are they now on this story?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm still doing everything pretty much on my own.
Okay. So they've all just kind of, hey, if you can just deliver us the story, we'd love to share it, but we don't want to put any work into it.
Exactly.
Oh, what a shame. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's absurd. Well, you got to get a GoFundMe page going then. We have to figure out a way to fund the rest of this story and get it taken care of. Now, let's jump back over to Paul. You've talked to your family. Obviously, things have come back around. You're communicating with your mother and father that raised you, correct?
Correct. Everything's terrific, yeah.
That's great. And they finally came to understand what the real reasoning is behind this story?
Yes, and we don't talk about it.
Okay. So it's another one of those, okay, we understand it, let's move on, you're our son, we're your parents, end of story.
That's it, yeah. And great. It's working out fine. Yeah.
And what about finding the real Paul? Is that something that they want you to do? Do they want to just leave that story buried? Where do they stand now?
They don't really want to know anything about what I'm doing. But I will tell you, I am not going to rest until I find some kind of answer, some kind of closure, or actually find Paul.
How far do you think you are from that moment? What more do you think it's going to take to get that information?
Well, I'm actually working on a really good lead right now, and hopefully we'll have some answers within the next month or so. This is something that I just got a tip yesterday that I'm going to start vetting out because it's a really good tip. And the good thing about this is somebody out there knows something. And the longer my story is out there, the better our chances of actually solving this,
right?
Because someone's got to come forward. And I answer everybody. Anyone who comes on my website or to Who Is Paul Facebook page, I respond. I don't take any tip for granted, and I'm open to any suggestions and help that I can get.
Well, we're here for you. How can people find you? What's the best way for people to reach out if they know anything about this case or may have some insights?
Okay, the best way is to go to foundlingpaul.com.
Foundlingpaul.com. And we'll put up a link to that. We'll also put up a link to the Facebook page so that if you're listening to this podcast, all you have to do is go search the information there and you'll see the two links. The best way is to reach out to Paul and get that information out there. Do you feel that this is something you are going to get an answer to in the next few years, or are you maybe a little bit more reticent in that kind of belief at this point?
David, we are going to solve both these mysteries. I know it, and I'm not going to rest until we do. That's just the way it's going. That's my reality.
Well, we wish you all the luck in the world. The book, what can people expect from the book? Why did you want to write this when the story is not complete?
Okay, so the book, I didn't start out this whole thing to write a book. But as I started this journey, I realized from responses from people that I was actually helping people.
Sure.
And so if this book could serve as an inspiration to people searching for meaning in their lives, then I actually committed myself to sharing all the details of my search for that reason. Because I want people to understand that you can't live a lie. We need to know who we are. There are certain things in our DNA that make us who we are. And I knew that because I wasn't anything like my parents.
Right.
But my daughter came out just like me. She's playing guitar and she's into acting and music and everything. And that's something it's not passed down. It's in our DNA. People need to know who they are. And the best way to do that is to start that journey, no matter what the cost. I've lost a lot and I've gained a lot through this whole journey, but the point is you have to take it.
Who is Paul Fronczak? That's the Facebook page. We'll have links up for that. Paul, please keep us in mind and let us know as you continue this journey. And if there's anything we can do to help continue to spread the word, we will certainly do it both on Darkness Radio and on True Crime Tuesday. We wish you much success with this. What a fascinating story. And again, I just want to congratulate you that, man, what a together guy you are. So many other people might have fallen apart knowing all of this soap opera twists and turns, but it seems to have only strengthened your resolve in who you really are as a person. And I applaud you for that because that is really incredible.
David, thank you so much for the kind words. Thank you for having me on your show. And thanks to all your listeners. You never know. They might be the ones who solve this for us.
Well, we'll certainly hope so, and we'll keep pushing the information out there and spread the word to other shows that we know of to see if there's other people that can help get your story out there.
Great. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you so much. Paul Fronczak, our guest Amazing story, folks. You've got to pick up this book and read it for yourself. The Foundling, the true story of a kidnapping, a family secret, and my search for the real me. We've got the links up for that book. We will keep in touch with Paul so that we know what's going on with this story as it continues to evolve, and we will keep you, our listeners, updated. Now, though, it's time to lighten the mood. Let's take a look at what's going on in the world around us, Tim. It looks like Florida man is back at it with more dumb crimes and stupid criminals. Our first story, Tim, is in Salt Lake City, Utah. We'll give Florida man a chance to take a breath before we dive into his stories. And trust me, we have some this week. But authorities say a Utah woman pulled two of her son's teeth in a Walmart restroom.
Ooh.
Now, I know Walmart's got discount vision, Tim, and discount photography, but I guess I didn't realize they were looking at maybe bringing in discount dentistry. Prosecutor said Monday that the 47-year-old woman bought hand sanitizer and needle nose pliers from the store, then took them into the restaurant and pulled two of her 7-year-old son's teeth. Police in American Fork, Utah said the boy's older brother heard the child screaming and got him out of the bathroom on April 2nd. Charging documents say the boy told his brother that one of the teeth was loose, but the other one was only slightly loose. Prosecutors say the woman didn't use any kind of anesthetic. The woman was charged with felony child abuse. No attorney was immediately listed for her in court records. The Associated Press is not naming her to avoid identifying the children. Well, all right. I got to be really careful on this. But, I mean, how is that much worse than tying your tooth to, like, the bumper of a car and taking off?
Or, oh, who does that?
Well, that was a big thing when we were kids. You'd tie it to the trailer hitch and your dad would pull out and pop it. Or you'd tie your tooth and then tie it to a doorknob and then somebody would slam the door.
All right, a doorknob. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Or just reach in and pull it. But
yeah, but I mean, how is this any different? You're just helping your kid out.
A car, Dave? They drag you behind a car?
No, you didn't get dragged, Tim. What do you think?
Like in vacation?
These things are rooted into your skull? No, they pop out pretty easy when a car guns it and takes off.
No.
Now, I wonder how many people I've just inspired. But that was a thing, at least where I grew up. But talking about parents, the parent we just talked about, she's going to seem like Mary Poppins in a second, Tim. Are you ready for this story?
All right.
An unnamed Florida woman is reportedly being investigated by local law enforcement and child services after allegedly allowing a snake to repeatedly bite her 1-year-old daughter. The woman later shared the video on Facebook, and after it went viral, law enforcement stepped in to investigate. Now, Tim, I'm not an attorney. I know that's hard to believe because I'm so smart.
Really?
But how is it allegedly allowing a snake to repeatedly bite her 1-year-old daughter when she has video of it? There's no more alleging. At that point, you pretty much got it down, don't you?
I think so, yeah. I think at that point you've succeeded. Yeah.
Tampa Bay's ABC Action News reported that the woman in question has no regrets.
Yeah,
instead insisted that in allowing the snake to bite her daughter, it taught her a valuable lesson, Tim. It had bitten me and my son and didn't leave a mark several times, she said. I thought it was a good opportunity to introduce her without actually getting hurt. People are just too sensitive, she said.
Oh, God.
The woman insisted that the baby was not injured by the snake because the snake's fangs never pierced the child's flesh. People who know me know I would never hurt my children, she insisted. The video has been removed from Facebook, but it is unclear whether or not the woman was charged with any crimes to date. The video, Tim, is horrible. It's a small snake. I don't know what kind of snake it is, but it's a kind that I don't want to be bitten by because it's a snake. And this baby's like reaching over for it and it keeps batting and biting at this kid. Well, she needs to learn a valuable lesson. No, she doesn't. So I think what we should do is tie the mother down and spread honey all over her body and then let red ants climb over her so she can learn the very important lesson not to put honey on her body and lay on red ant hills. Because that's a valuable lesson, Tim. She should be taught that.
Well, yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, because what?
Yeah, right? That is bonkers. Bonkers. Yeah. Well, here, let's keep it classy, Tim. We are in Florida.
Oh, okay.
Let's go to Clearwater, where a 27-year-old Christina Joy Rivera showed up at her ex-boyfriend's home, hoping to have a little bit of the loving, Tim. Loving, touching, and squeezing, according to deputies. She left in handcuffs. Well, it sounds like that was a success after all. Oh, no, no. She left in handcuffs after she continuously punched the woman she found in his bed. According to Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, Rivera had been sending her ex-boyfriend text messages saying that she wanted to come over to have sex. Her ex did not reply to the messages, but she decided to show up at his house anyway. Well, you got to give her credit for being, you know, proactive. The police report states that when Rivera got to the house around 5 a.m., the front door was closed, and so she had to force her way into the house. When she got inside, she found her ex and his new girlfriend laying in bed. Without saying a word or knowing who the woman was, Rivera walked into the bedroom and began punching the woman repeatedly in the face. It could have been a nun, too.
Ooh.
It could have been a nun that was weary and tired, and her clothes had been...
A nun laying in bed.
Right, and her clothes had been infested with the smell of wild bush from being outside, so she'd removed them.
Right.
And she was weary from feeding children and starving kittens, Tim. And she was just laying in bed, and this man, the kindness of his heart, was simply massaging the nun to help her relax because of her long work. She had no clue who this woman was. And this poor nun, this cat-saving, wild bush-scented nun, laying in bed, trying to relax, just got the absolute crap pummeled out of her because of an ex-crabby girlfriend. Good God. The woman was bleeding and suffered minor injuries to her face. Rivera denied the allegations that she punched the woman in the face and told deputies that she was invited over to the house. Well, who wouldn't invite her? She sounds charming. Rivera was arrested. What?
Oh, it wasn't so much punching her in the face, Dave. It was a face massage. He was massaging her back, and she was trying to massage her face.
Yeah, she was just getting in with it. It was like a shiatsu.
Yeah, right.
That heavy shiatsu. Yeah. She was arrested and charged with felony burglary with assault and battery. She remains in jail on a $150,000 bond and is currently awaiting her first court hearing. I'll tell you this, Tim, she's kind of a looker, and she's obviously looking for sex. So if you want to pony up that money and bail her out, I think you got a sure thing.
Well, she's a little volatile, isn't she?
Ah, Tim, come on. You make it sound like that's a bad thing. Let's take it away from Florida for a little bit, Tim. Let's take it away and go somewhere far off, somewhere that's almost tropical and magical in nature. We're going to go to Florida, Tim. Florida. Marion County, Florida, where deputies have arrested a Marion County man for walking down a highway completely naked and damaging a patrol car. On Wednesday, deputies spotted 18-year-old Andrew Humphreys walking down South U.S. Highway 441 completely naked after leaving the scene of a vehicle accident. Well, maybe he smelled of wild bush, Tim. Maybe he was tired of feeding kittens and was on his way to go find somebody's bed to lay down in for a massage. Concerned for the man's well-being, a deputy started talking to him. Humphreys then walked to the front of the deputy's patrol car and tried to open the driver's door, which was locked. The deputy placed him in handcuffs due to his erratic behavior. The man then began kicking the rear passenger door of the car and pulling on the metal cage, causing $1,000 in damage. That's a naked teen with handcuffs on, Tim. $1,000 in damage. Deputies believe the entire door will likely need to be replaced. Now, later on, the Florida Highway Patrol called the Marion County deputy to tell him witnesses at the scene of the crash said when Humphreys left the original accident scene, he walked up to a vehicle parked at the sheriff's office, district office, and tried to open its door. He pulled the door handle off the vehicle when he couldn't get in. What is this kid, the Hulk? He pulled a handle off the door and then kicked the door enough to do $1,000 in damage. Officials say he urinated on the vehicle, which belonged to Marion County deputy. The damage caused was $700. Humphreys is charged with one count of felony criminal mischief, property damage, and one misdemeanor count of criminal mischief. The FHP is conducting a separate investigation into the vehicle crash he was originally involved in. Do you think it was like a head injury that made him this nuts? Or is it going to be the dope, Tim?
Oh, it's always the dope, Dave.
The flacca.
Yeah. Way to go. You're into the kids' dope these days. I mean, literally into it. I mean, you got the names down.
Yeah, the Flacca.
Good for you.
Tim.
The Flacca.
Tim, shall we move away from Florida?
Well, let's, yeah.
I wish I could. The next story takes place in Lakeland, Florida, Tim. And I'm not making this up. I don't specifically go out looking for Florida-only stories. It's just like when I look for dumb crimes, Florida's the only ones that pop up on a regular basis. Authorities say a man who was wearing baggy blue jeans managed to stuff 15 quart-sized bottles of Pennzoil motor oil and 30 DVDs down his pants before walking out of a 7-Eleven in Lakeland. Unfortunately for the thief, a Polk County Sheriff's Office detective happened to be parked outside and saw the whole thing happen. After walking out of the store, the man walked past the detective, who was sitting in an unmarked vehicle that was parked outside the 7-Eleven. PCSO Detective Phil Ryan said he got out of his car and confronted William Jason Hall, 38, and told him to remove all of the items from his pants. Surveillance video recorded Hall as he pulled 30 treasure hunt DVDs and 15 bottles of motor oil from his pants. Hall was arrested on a charge of petty theft, but it was his third arrest on the charge, so he was charged with a felony. How is that petty theft? When you've got 30 jugs of oil and a bunch of DVDs down your, or I'm sorry, 15 jugs of oil and 30 DVDs, that seems like that'd be a much bigger thing.
But it was treasure hunt, right? So they're probably, going for $5 a pop?
Yeah, maybe three. Yeah.
Yeah. So they figure $90 in DVDs and probably
15 bucks.
You probably got about less than $100 in oil.
Well, I guess.
You got 15 quarts, jugs, right?
What, about $4, $5 a pop?
$4 or $5 a head, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'll give the guy a break.
$75 in oil.
I mean, it's Florida, for God's sakes. That's a pretty tame crime. He's not, like, letting snakes bite his kid, at least. Palm Harbor, Florida, Tim, an Uber driver has been arrested after apparently ripping an expensive item off a customer who he accused of not paying. According to Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, Jared Combs said his friend were getting dropped off outside a Palm Harbor home early Sunday morning, but seconds after getting out of the car, they say their Uber driver got out of control. The driver, Alexander Troy, had picked up the men from a friend's house and was scheduled to drop Jared off at his home, then take his friend to his house, but the friend needed to run inside Jared's house to grab something. Before he could do that, the two say Troy started peeling out and yelling at them out the window. Troy then apparently got out of his car, ran after them up the driveway, claiming they canceled their fare and didn't pay. Combs tried showing the driver their receipt, but instead of calming down, he says the driver ripped his pricey gold chain his friend was wearing right off and then drove away. You're supposed to use Uber for going home safe instead of being out here worrying about driving and all that. I mean, you shouldn't have to be assaulted and robbed by an Uber driver. You're supposed to feel safe and all that, but I definitely didn't feel safe at that night, said Combs. Pinellas County deputies arrested Alexander a couple of hours later at his house in Clearwater. The gold chain was still in his car. He's now charged with strong arm robbery. Which usually, Uber drivers are just really guilty of highway robbery, really, is what it comes down to. Pinellas County.
They're really also guilty. Yeah, they're guilty also of having really good mints and water in the car for you as well.
I see, I've never tried an Uber. Have you?
Yeah. No. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
You like Ubering?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of a neat way to travel. Yeah.
Pinellas County deputies say they verified Jared and the friend had paid for their Uber ride. When the article author reached out to Uber for a comment, they said the behavior described by the rider is clearly unacceptable and that Alexander Troy has been removed from the app as a driver while the investigation continues, Tim.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here. Wow, Tim, you've got to be pissed off to do this.
What did I do?
Not you specifically.
Okay.
Yeah, this story takes place in Maine, Tim. So I'm going to take you away from Florida, finally. A man in Maine who became upset after being told he did not qualify for government benefits unleashed a cup of live bed bugs at a city office, officials say. The incident took place Friday afternoon and forced the evacuation of the Augusta City Center, according to CentralMaine.com. City manager William Bridgego said that about 100 bed bugs were released. The building will be sprayed, and bed bug detecting dog service will inspect the building before reopening on Monday, Bridgego said. The man, whose identity was not immediately available, released the bed bugs after he was told by a city employee that he did not qualify for assistance. The bed bugs were in a cup, which the man slammed on the counter of the office, sending the bugs flying onto the desk and floor. Police caught up with the man, and he signed a criminal complaint and a trespass order. More charges are expected, Bridgego says.
Man, this would be pissed. This would be a concept for the world's worst supervillain ever.
What, Bed Bug Man?
The Bed Bug.
Yeah.
Just coming in with a cup of bed bugs and slamming them down.
Slamming it on the old countertop, trying to make a point. Oh, bed bugs are so horrible.
But think about all that damage from just that cup. First of all, you had to... This was not like a spur-of-the-moment type of crime. Like he got pissed off and he's like, what can I grab that... That'll just piss these people off. Right. He had to sit and think about this.
No, he was ready.
And then he had to gather all these bed bugs.
Yeah. Or maybe he didn't have to. Maybe they're all over his home. You don't know. Maybe that's why he was pissed off. He wasn't qualifying for assistance. I don't know. Let's wrap it up here, Tim. From bed bugs to peacocks. Let me see your peacock cock cock. Your peacock cock. Have you ever heard that song by the lovely and talented Katy Perry?
No, that is unusual.
Yeah, that was a song I overheard my young daughters at the time walking around singing, and I'm like, wait, what? Yeah, there's nothing in your life better than listening to your 7- and 8-year-old daughters walking around saying, let me see your peacock cock cock, your peacock cock. Makes me reevaluate that maybe Katy Perry's music is not good for children under the age of 12.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. But to my daughter's credit, she did always think that the Katy Perry was singing I Kissed a Boy and I Liked It. So that's good.
Oh,
that part
well,
was good.
There you go.
A wild animal, glass bottles, and a giant net create a cocktail for disaster. A female peacock cock cock, technically called a peahen. I did not know that. Really?
I wouldn't pee on a hen. They sue.
Yeah. They smashed up an Arcadia, California liquor store on Monday. According to the Associated Press, the peahen strolled through the open door of Royal Oaks Liquor Store and was unnoticed by the store's manager, Ronnie Ganem, until a customer asked him about El Polo, or the chicken in Spanish. Ganem then tried to guide the bird out of the store, but his advances ruffled her feathers. Spooked, the peahen flew directly at Ganem and then to the top shelf of the store. This was really out of my comfort zone, Ganem told the CBS Los Angeles. I was kind of scared. I didn't know what to do. So the 21-year-old manager decided to call 911, and an animal control officer wearing protective gloves and carrying a comically large fishing net arrived on the scene. And that's when the rager began. He was trying to get it with the fishing net, and the bird jumped on the first wine bottle. When that happened, I was like, oh, this is about to become a big mess, Ganem told the AP. He tried to get it again with the net. It went straight diving into all the bottles, and the more he kept moving on trying to use that net, the more it kept on flapping its wings and knocking everything over. Realizing that the animal control officer was unintentionally acting as the peahen's destruction wingman, Ganem decided to intervene. He put on a sweatshirt to protect his arms from the bird's claws and eventually apprehended the animal. After about 90 minutes in the store, the bird caused about $500 worth of damage.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, she's got expensive taste. She was breaking up the good bottles of vino, Tim.
Yeah, yeah. She wasn't going for the Ripple and for the Boone's Farm, that's for sure.
Right. All right, yeah. Mad Dog 2020. Don't forget that good stuff.
Yeah.
This next story, I actually have to admit that I can kind of sympathize with the criminal in the story, Tim.
Yeah?
Yeah. Talking about raising a big stink, a man is facing charges after he allegedly threatened to shoot a Pittsburgh restaurant owner because there were onions in his food. Oh, I hate that, Tim. I really? Hate it. If I could, I would blow dart my waiter and cooking staff when I order something without onions and it comes with onions.
Ugh. Really? Ugh. I like onions.
I do, but it's got to be in the right thing, the right meal. But when you specifically say, I don't want onions in this, and then they come out and you take a big bite and it's just oniony. Oh, man, if I had a blow dart, that's what I'd be doing, Tim. I don't think I'd pull out a gun and threaten the owner, but just blow dart him and walk out.
If you could compromise with the slingshot, would you do that?
No, I'm sticking with blow darts.
Okay.
Yeah, those are the lost art, Tim.
Yeah, they really are.
Yuba Sharma was arrested Tuesday night outside the All India restaurant after officers responded to a call about a man described as drunk and angry, or as we like to call him, drangry, Tim.
Right.
Owner Ravadir Singh told the police that the suspect showed up Tuesday evening in a drunken rage, still mad that the servers put onions in his food the night before. Oh, by that time, you should be over it. According to the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, investigators say the 43-year-old Sharma was asked multiple times to leave, but refused. Instead, he reached for his pants pocket while allegedly threatening to shoot the owner, according to KDKA. That's when police were called to the scene. Before the police arrived, Sharma allegedly pulled down his pants and exposed himself to the owner and a restaurant employee. Well, that's a totally different kind of blowgun than I was talking about, Tim.
Well, and then he yelled, "You want to see my blooming onion?"
Yeah.
See, that's what he did.
Well played. Initially, the owner did not want to pursue charges, but changed his mind, telling police that he no longer felt safe in his own restaurant. Police described Sharma as being so drunk he was speaking nonsense. According to the station, he allegedly told an officer that he was arguing with staff because they put onions in his food. Police said Sharma physically resisted being placed in the back of the cruiser. Sharma, 43, is currently being held in the Allegheny County Jail on charges of terroristic threats, indecent exposure, public drunkenness, and resisting arrest, according to the Associated Press. Well, isn't that fancy?
Yeah.
Fancy, fancy, fancy. Well, that's it, Tim. That wraps up another week on True Crime Tuesdays. And we've had a great a couple of episodes lately. I hope people really enjoyed today's show because I was astounded by the story of Paul Fronczak. And I think everybody listening, this is an amazing story. Pick up the book. You have to read the whole story for yourself. But this guy is remarkable. And what a crazy story. And next week, it doesn't get any better, Tim. We've got some weird cases to cover for you. It is really one of the cooler true crime stories that we're going to cover as well. And I don't know. We're really lucking out with some amazing guests lately, and I hope people will continue to keep supporting us and checking that out. Thank you all for being a part of this. And remember to share True Crime Tuesday with your friends. It's really easy. It's inexpensive, and it's a great, great program to listen to. I'm just saying that because I'm part of it. I could be wrong, but, I like to think we have a pretty good product going here, Tim.
I think we do as well, yeah.
Well, thank you all for joining us and being a part of our world. We'll be back again next week with you on a brand new True Crime Tuesday.